details in there, which is the dilaton effective action, but now add supersymmetry. This got some supersymmetric water identities that I learned about studying amplitudes, and now they come up here, which is fun. And then finally end up with a few conclusions and outlook. So to start with, suppose I have some conformal field theory, and let me do something to it. Deform it, for example, I'll add a relevant operator so that I get a flow. And let's suppose that this flow is such that I end up in the infrared with another conformal field theory. So I have a UV theory and I have an IR theory. Now, intuitively, as we go from high energies to low energies, we expect to lose degrees of freedom. We expect to lose informations along the way. But one of the key questions is, how exactly do you quantify this in a field theory? And if we go ahead and look at what happens in two dimensions, this is called the C theorem. The quantity, there is a quantity which is the central charge in the UV and the IR, in the CFTs. The central charge is strictly decreasing so that along an RG flow. And this is called the C theorem. So we can characterize C, well, it's the central charge in the Virasoro algebra, but we can also characterize it in terms of the trace anomaly. So in a conformal field theory, the trace of the stress tensor is zero in a flat background. But suppose I put it in a curved background, then there can be an anomaly. And this anomaly has a coefficient, which is a dimensionless constant C, which is the C that is decreasing in this theorem, times the thing that carries the dimension, namely the only two-derivative invariant I can form, a Lorentz invariant, which is the Ricci scalar. So this is the trace anomaly. And as you can see directly in a flat background, you certainly get zero from this. Okay. And this guy here is the central charge. And I'm dropping normalization constants and so on that may sit there in front. And that's the central charge that you see here in the C theorem. So this C theorem was proven by Samolodchikov. In 1986. And basically, what he found was that there is a function of the energy scale in the problem that is monotonically decreasing along the flow, and whose values at the end of the flow is this central charge. And it's stationary also at the endpoint. So at the end of the flow, it coincides with the central charges. And this is how you prove that CUV is greater than CIR. Okay, now this type of logic assumes that you have a Lorentz invariant theory and unitarity. So this will be an underlying assumption of what we'll do along the way today. Okay, so let's go ahead to four dimensions and see what the structure is there. So in four dimensions, we can again look at the trace of the stress tensor. But now there's a little more structure. We have to look at four derivative invariants. And so one typical basis to choose is that you could have the Weyl tensor squared, or you could have the Euler density. Which, in terms of maybe more familiar object, is Riemann squared minus 4 times Ricci squared plus R squared, which is just the Ricci scalar squared. And you could also have something like box R, which I'll give a coefficient. Let's call it B. But it turns out that this term here, you can always remove by a counter term, so we won't talk any more about this. So the physical constants that sit in front here are C and A, those are the central charges in this case. And you would look at some logic of C theorem and expect that maybe there could be decreasing, that these guys could be decreasing functions. Now, it turns as a function of the RG flow. It turns out that this is not true for C, but it was proposed in 1988 by Kadi that there is an A theorem in analog with some logic of C theorem that says that A decreases along an along the RG flow between two CFTs. So that the A quantity in the UV is always greater than the one in the IR. Now, this was not proven until 2011, where Komogatsky and Swimmer provided a proof that I'll review for you shortly. I'll refer to this just often as just the KS argument. Okay, so we talked about 2D and 4D, and that in those cases, it's the central charges C and A, respectively, that loosely speaking encodes this sense of loss of degrees of freedom as you go from high energies to low energies. So we can talk about other dimensions too. I'll mention that at the end of the talk. But what I will do in this talk is to focus on a certain aspect of the Komogatsky Swimmer proof in the context of n equals 1 supersymmetry. So if you wish, it gives an n equals 1 supersymmetric story of that. So in this talk, n equals to 1, SUSY version of KS. Okay, and specifically, it'll be in d equals 4 dimensions. And at the very end, I'll tell you why we got interested in this question to begin with. But that's secret for now. Okay, so that's the first part, roughly speaking, the introduction. Now, in order to tell you more specifically about what aspect where n equals 1 supersymmetry starts playing a role and the questions we want to address, I have to tell you a little bit more about Komogatsky's and Swimmer's argument for the C theorem. So let's move some all the way up and go on to part two. Okay, so I will do this in a very specific context where I'll think of my CFT as having a moduli space, so that here's the CFT. If I go out on the moduli space, I'm turning on some VEVs, and now I get my flow down to some IR CFT. So this is supposed to look like some kind of moduli space. This is not too important here because the argument will generalize to more explicit breakings of conformal symmetry anyway. Now, given that I take the conformal symmetry and turn on a VEV, I'm breaking conformal symmetry spontaneously. And when I do that, I know that I get a Goldstone mode for the broken symmetry. And this is what we call the dilaton. And I'll give a name to the associated field. Let's call it tau of x. And the key ingredient in the KS argument is to understand the effective action for this dilaton mode. So the low energy effective action for this dilaton is what we'll focus on most of this, throughout most of this talk. And the key idea is that this low energy effective action, the form that it can possibly take, the terms that can enter into this action, are all determined by symmetry. So it's termed to symmetry up to coefficients of those terms. So the form is determined by symmetries in a way that I'll explain further. Okay, so the idea here is the following. If I do a Weyl transformation on this effective action, what it should give me is the anomaly. So that'll be a little more explicit. So if I do a Weyl transformation, that's a rescaling of the metric. So my metric scales by an overall factor. Let's call it e to the 2 sigma of x. And of course, the background metric can depend on the space-time coordinates too. And given that I have this transformation, I also have a shift in my Goldstone boson. It transforms by a shift symmetry. So simply by a shift in sigma. Now, under this transformation, the action should transform into the anomaly, which you can see by simply just looking at what the effective action is in terms of the partition function. And so in particular, let's see, how many blackboards do we have? In particular, and here I'll just give a bit of an overview of the argument. In particular, you'll have the following. You start with a UE theory. It goes to an infrared theory, plus, let's think of this as the piece that is governed by the effective action of the dilaton. Now, if I do a Weyl transformation, an infinitesimal Weyl transformation, the UV theory will have some associated trace of the stress tensor, whose anomalies are CUV. Anomaly coefficients are CUV and CA, and AUV. And similarly, this happens also for the IR theory. And so the associated coefficients there are, of course, the corresponding IR quantities. And the idea is that since the symmetry, conformal symmetry, is spontaneously broken, it shouldn't change the trace of the stress tensor as an operator identity. So whatever happens here has to be the same on both sides. And that means that whatever comes out of the Weyl variation of the effective action for the dilaton should be associated with the change in the anomalies, from the two other ones. So specifically, it has to compensate precisely for the difference between the anomalies in the UV and the IR. So this is the anomaly matching argument that connects the dilaton effective action to the change in the anomalies going between the two. And so specifically, this anomaly matching argument what it tells you is that if I do a Weyl variation of the dilaton effective action, what I get is an integral over sigma of x times the anomaly. But now, where did the anomaly go? All the way here. But now with coefficients that are the changes that reflect the flows of the coefficients of the central charges. So this goes to delta C times the Weyl tensor squared minus delta A times the Euler density. And so this quantity here will be the starting point of the argument. So at this stage, you should complain because I've only said something about what characterizes the variation of this. So anything that I add to the action that is Weyl invariant is, of course, unchanged by the Weyl transformations. And so this must be ambiguous up to Weyl invariants. And indeed it is, and those are some of the constants. The coefficients of those Weyl invariants are something that you have to figure out whether they matter for the argument you want to use or whether they don't, and so whether you can determine them. So this is what basically we're going to do. So I'll be more explicit about that in a minute. So let's say here that this determines the effective action for the dilaton up to Weyl invariant terms that you'd have to worry about, and that will play a central role for what we do. Okay, now let me just tell you the result to start with of this analysis. So the result was actually first found by Swimmer and Tyson in a paper about the year before the Komogatsky-Swimmer work, and was re-derived by Swimmer and Komogatsky. So it looks as follows. Let's just write it down. Okay, so we write it down in a general background with a metric G, and it takes the following form. There are two derivative terms. That looks like this. Okay. And then the four derivative terms, which take the following form. And we'll discuss the form as I'm done reading it, writing it down. Okay, so let's take a look at this. Now, the first term up here turns out to be a violent variant combination. This combination here is really, together with the overall metric, is really, really violent invariant. And so this is one of those terms that I said you have to put in, and that whose coefficients you a priori can't fix. So here the coefficient is simply just fixed essentially up to an overall constant to be canonical. So we won't worry too much about that. But what you see is that this gives you the kinetic term for the dilaton. Now, the second term here is more interesting and more key. So what happens under a Weyl transformation, as we've seen, the dilaton shifts. So this term here, exactly this whole line here, exactly generates the anomaly that you wanted to generate. Now, that's from the variation of tau. From the variation of what is inside here, the Weyl tensor squared, well, it's the Weyl tensor, so that doesn't change under conformal scaling like this. So this is invariant. But the Euler density actually transforms. So it transforms, and it gives you something that will be quadratic in tau, this piece times whatever. Sorry, if you keep something that is of order tau times sigma from the transformation. So you need something that can cancel this, something that involves curvature here, the Einstein tensor, times 2 tau. So the variation of 1 tau here gives a sigma that gives something of the right order to cancel this term after partial integrations. But then there's also a term where the curvature piece here will transform, and you get something that's quadratic in taus and linear in sigma. And fancifully, this is actually canceled by the variation of this term. But then this term produces something else that you need to cancel, and you get here. And now this one makes sure everything truncates at this state and is finite and invariant. You can also have gotten this answer. It's not magic that it actually truncates. You could have gotten this answer directly also from integrating the anomaly using the Wessomino trick. So it's not magic. It's simply just a result of that. Okay, so that's the idea. But what is very nice now is that when I take this action and reduce to flat space, so let's take the flat space limit. What we find is that some pieces actually survive the process. So there's a kinetic term that survives. And we notice, of course, the curvatures here, all those go away. Notice that there's no trace left of the central charge C after taking the flat space limit. But there are terms here that survive. The Einstein tensor part, of course, cancels. Of course, zero. But there's two terms left here. And so let's write those down. So there's minus d tau squared box tau plus 2 d tau to the fourth. So actually, there's some information left over. Now, you notice that the kinetic term here is a little bit non-standard. So let's put it in a more standard form by doing a field redefinition where I change variables from tau to some phi. And this phi here now has the benefit of being what we'd call the physical dilaton. And by that, I simply mean that its equation of motion, as you see in a second, is box tau equal to zero. So as a mode, it's really truly a massless mode. Okay, so now the effective action takes the form. Well, there's a kinetic term that is just the usual canonical term. And I'm being a little schematic here, so let me just say that this action contains two essential terms, the kinetic term as well as a term that is quartic in phi. And so what am I going to do with that? Well, what I notice from this is that I can compute the scattering of the process of two phis scattering to two phis, and that whole process is determined completely up to an overall constant, which turns out to be positive, as delta A times the only Mandelstam polynomial that is symmetric in S, T, and U, and has order p to the fourth, as it must. And so up to an overall constant, which we won't bother about, this is the answer. Yes?
Why do we ignore the tadpole term, e to the minus 4 tau?
E to the minus 4 tau, where are you looking?
It gets in the effective action, you could have an e to the minus 4 tau.
Very good. E to the minus 4 tau.
So there's a cosmological term like this that could in principle be there, and which would be a violin variant. So since I assume that we had spontaneous breaking, that I have a truly Goldstone mode, such a term cannot be there because this would give rise to a mass for the dilaton. So for spontaneously broken case, this can be dropped. Good. You should also ask similarly about higher order terms for derivative violin variants. Yes? Yes? So you know for this case here that it's, well, so maybe you want to attack my statement that I say that it's determined by the symmetries up to the violin variants. But those violin variants, I either have to show that they don't contribute or fix their coefficients by other means. That other means can be using things such as I know that there's no mass for the dilaton. We'll also see later that I'll fix coefficients using supersymmetry, for example. Okay, very good. So what Kumagatsky, can you see behind the podium to some extent? Okay, so what Kumagatsky and Swimmer noticed was that they could use the fact that this 2-to-2 scattering process is proportional to the flow of the central charge A to extract a positivity statement of A. And it roughly goes as follows. So consider the amplitude in the forward limit, but divided by S cubed. You see that is something that has a pole, a simple pole at S equal to 0. So if I draw the S plane, then I'll have a pole here. And I can complete the contour. Well, for a total amplitude, a full amplitude, there are also going to be branch cuts. So if I can deform the contour, a small contour here that picks up the residue at that pole. So for the pole at 0, the residue up to constants is clearly just delta A. But that then must be equal to whatever I get by deforming the contour to go around the rest. So I can deform it to infinity. You can argue by noticing the fall off of the amplitude at large energies that you don't pick up anything from the contours here, the big circle contours. So all you pick up are from the branch cuts. Now on the branch cuts, the combination that you get from the different parts of the contours here combine up to give you the imaginary value of the amplitude in the forward limit. We have to divide by S cubed. And then simply it reduces to integrating over all S from the beginning of the branch cuts, let's call it S0, to infinity. Well, so what? Well, the imaginary value of the amplitude is equal to S times the total cross-section. And so now we immediately see that we're integrating over a positive definite integrand. And so this quantity must be positive. And so it follows that delta A is positive. And of course, that's the statement that AUV is necessarily greater than AIR. And that is the very rough outline of the Kumagatsky Swimmer argument. Okay. So you notice that one of the key steps in this process was the form of the effective action as we got it through the steps here. And it was based on having just one Goldstone mode in the story. So you might ask what happens if we have another massless mode in the story here. And there's a general context in which you have another massless mode, and that is when you have supersymmetry. So let me try to explain that. So let's now add supersymmetry.
Isolate the Wessonino term from the other stuff.
The coupling constant, the what?
I remember there was this coupling constant F that you take to infinity.
Oh, very good. Okay, so.
And that's supposed to tell you the coupling constant.
I didn't put in the constants all along.
So you're asking about the case, what if it's not spontaneously broken?
So
good. So if the F that you're talking about is essentially in this case here the value of the VEP that I put in. And so for the problem, it sets the scale of the breaking as well as whatever that coupling F is. So let me just put in an aside here. So you're asking, what if you have explicit breaking? In the sense that I'm adding some relevant operator to the theory. So what you do there to introduce tau is that for every mass scale you have, then you replace that mass scale by m times e to the minus tau. And this restores, so while this breaks, the mass scale, of course, will break conformal symmetry explicitly, the conformal symmetry is restored by tau. It basically acts as a compensator. So now this comes in as a compensator. Okay. Now, in the following sense, okay, so now if I take tau and I do the field redefinition as we just did before, and I can put in an F here to restore dimensions also, and this is the F that you were asking about, then basically what this corresponds to is that I'm giving a VEV to my compensator. So now I'm breaking the conformal symmetry again spontaneously. I'm back up in this case here, and I can pull through the same type of argument. Now with phi here being the fluctuation, so that's our Goldstone mode just as before. So it's the same story. So now, the key property here is that I have two different scales to play with. I have an M and an F. And since I'm free to pick whatever F I want, I can pick an F so that this quantity is always very small, which means that my field here is arbitrarily weakly coupled. And now I can go and I can see calculate with it. So that's the idea.
So you don't have to worry about other massless modes.
Well, I might have to if they couple to the dilaton. It depends how they couple to the dilaton compared with this quantity here. If they couple at the same order as everything else, if they're massless, that I don't think they need to have any relation to this guy. So let me give you an example in which this happens. So in n equals 4, in explicit case. So I wanted to give you a spontaneously broken example where there are other modes. So that would be on the Coulomb branch of n equals 4, where there are five other modes in order that the dilaton multiplet can form a full n equals 4 massless multiplet. In the explicitly broken case, let's come back to that. So
their proof was incomplete.
The what, sir?
You said their proof was incomplete.
No, I think it's not incomplete. I think they thought about this but didn't write it down. But okay, so good. So let's see what we do here. So in supersymmetry, the stress tensor is in the same multiplet, in the same supermultiplet. As the U1 R current. Let's call it JR. And so now, when I break the conformal symmetry, I also break the U1 R at the same time. And just as I have a Goldstone mode here that we call tau, I also have one for this one, which we can call beta. And so these two come together. And in fact, if you write in n equals 1 superformalism, superfields, then these two combine into a chiral superfield, where tau is the real part, and I beta x is the other part, is the imaginary part. So actually, well, I'll come back to your question and say why this beta intuitively shouldn't affect anything. And I think that's the simple argument why things go through. OK, so what happens is now that the anomalies have contributions from a background. They have, well, you take the theory both in a gravitational background as before, but also now in a U1R background, so you can turn on a background gauge field too. And your anomaly, the Weyl anomaly or the trace anomaly, now takes the form as before, but with a new contribution that involves the background gauge field. And in addition, there's also a gauge anomaly, which takes the usual form that you know as F dual, and its coefficient is determined by supersymmetry to be this combination of A and C, 2,5A minus 3C. And there's also another contribution from the fact that we're in a curved background that goes as R dual. And all these coefficients here, in a general theory without supersymmetry, these would be arbitrary. But when you have supersymmetry, they're fixed in terms of A and C by supersymmetry. Oops. Okay. This has been known for a long time. And again, G mu nu and F, which is determined in terms of some gauge potential A, are really just the background fields for the story just as before. Okay. So the questions we want to address, are the following. One is, what is now the bosonic part of the dilaton effective action when you have full supersymmetry? And the dilaton effective action depends on both tau and beta. Oops, here we go. And then the other part is that does beta affect the KS argument? Now, intuitively, you will look at this and notice that beta, while tau is a scalar, beta is a pseudoscalar. And so you would not expect a pseudoscalar in a parity invariant theory to affect any tau scattering. You can't exchange just one pseudoscalar. That's not allowed. So based on this, that beta is a pseudoscalar, you would say that the tau scattering not affected, and everything should go through as before. And that is true, and that is what we'll find. But it'll actually be interesting for us to look a little more in detail exactly how that happens. So notice that in order to go from tau to the actual physical dilaton, we needed a field redefinition. Now, in this context here, we're going to do a field redefinition that mixes tau and beta to get the physical modes, which I'll call phi and xi. And so it may be a little intransparent what happens in the actual case, but the bottom line is that it still holds true that the dilaton will not affect the argument for the A theorem. So what I'll focus on mostly is the form of this action. And there's a second motivation for that in order to see how that works. And that is that there's a previous result in the literature for the n equals, so I should emphasize here that this is with n equals 1 SUSY. There was a previous result in the literature that gave a form of this. And so I want to show you that form. Dennis, can we roll down the projector, please? So I'm not going to write that out for you, but simply show you on a slide what that looks like. Okay. Does it have to find it? Do I have to do something with the lights? Okay, there we go. Okay, so here's what the dilaton effective action looks like with n equals 1 supersymmetry. So in 2010, Swimmer and Titan studied this for... Is this visible? Maybe the hockey stick is a better weapon. Okay, so Swimmer and Titan studied this action. They started by writing down the Weyl anomaly in superspace formalism. Then they integrated that with the Wessomino trick, got an answer in superspace form, and then expanded it in component form. So let's take a look at what it is. So the first part up here is recognizable. That's just our dilaton kinetic term. This was the part, the curvature piece, that makes it a Weyl invariant, these two terms together. And then you see that there's a new term here that combines our, that combines beta with A. And let me just mention that under, well, let's remind ourselves that under Weyl transformations, we have g mu nu scaling with e to the 2 sigma, while tau goes to tau plus sigma. And under Gates transformation, I have a mu nu going the usual way by some, let's Gates parameter, let's call it alpha. And then beta, as the Goldstone mode shifts, acts with the, is acted upon as a shift symmetry. Okay, so the first term up there, you see this term here in a flat space limit will just give you the kinetic term, but in the background of A, this is the Gates invariant combination that you can write down. Beta is the compensator for the broken U1, just in the way the tau was the compensator for the Weyl, breaking of the Weyl invariants. Okay, now the second line here has a new term, but otherwise it's exactly what we had before in the effective action. The piece that produces the Weyl anomaly is exactly this line here, and now with the F squared that I told you sits up there. The third line is also recognizable because under the Gates transformation, beta shifts to alpha, and so that tells you that the transformation of the action exactly is supposed to give you this Gates parameter times the Gates anomaly, just in the same way that the Weyl transformations gave us the Weyl anomaly. Okay, but so we understand the first three lines, but then we come down and we look at all this, and it's pretty scary. So maybe it's not so scary to begin with, but what it is scary about it is that it looks like it's not even Gates invariant. And what I mentioned very early on when we talked about the outline of the Komogatsky-Swimmer argument is that the Komogatsky-Swimmer story is fixed by something, some piece by some piece that gives you the exact anomaly under the transformations, under the symmetry transformations, plus things that are Weyl invariant. And in this case here, we should expand that to say Weyl and Gates invariant. And this doesn't look like it has that property at all. Now there's a dot, dot, dot here. And so the dot, dot, dot stands for terms that are higher powers in the field, in particular in beta and tau. And so what you have to hope is that what is in the dot, dot, dots somehow complete these terms into proper Weyl and Gates invariant terms. And so what we set out to do was to try to understand exactly how that happened in this case. You can also notice that if I remove everything that has to do with the U1R, then all the terms with beta go away. The first line here is completely dropped. The second line here has a couple of pieces that survive, but that gives exactly the combination that's the Einstein tensor. And the last line drops also. But you see that the terms that were cubic and quadratic and tau are gone. Oh, exactly. So the thing that is Gates non-invariant and produces the anomaly is this line here. So we already took care of that. Beta shifts to give the anomaly. So the rest of it better be gauge invariant. Now the role of the rest of it is to ensure supersymmetry from all the other pieces, but it should take a form that we're familiar with, and so that's what I want to try to show you. Okay, so Dennis, sorry to bother you again. Okay, so the reason I wrote this down again here is that these are really the principles by which we want to try to fix the effective action in the case of n equals 1 supersymmetry. So we would write the effective action as a term that is like the first two terms you saw on the top there that produces the anomalies, meaning the Bessemino term, plus terms that are invariant, and then in such a way that the whole combination ends up having n equals 1 supersymmetry. Okay, so it's very easy to write down and integrate the anomalies directly, both gauge and vial, and find out what the action looks like. And I'll write it down. It's very similar to what you just seen already. Okay, so there's this term which produces the anomaly. The vial anomaly, there's the other term that produces, sorry, delta C, delta A, FF tilde. Okay, so far so good. Everything looks very similar to before. Where dot, dot, dot here stands for higher derivative terms. So this is very similar to what we saw before, except there's this extra line with beta. And we have a bracket missing here. Okay. So this is what you get directly from the Bessemino trick based on these two conditions here. So we used up this property. Now, in the flat space limit, you'll notice that what survives here is really only those terms there with tau. And it seems it's perhaps intuitive, but if you have a theory with supersymmetry where only the real part of a complex scalar scatters and there are no interactions for the imaginary parts, that's just not possible. Supersymmetry requires that you have both, and I'm going to make that very explicit for you in a couple of minutes. So what we need to do is that this is, well, this is not SUSY by itself, so need to fix the vial and gauge invariant terms in this part here in order to restore full supersymmetry. And I'll show you then how to do that. So to build vial and gauge invariant pieces, it's convenient to introduce a metric G hat, which is G times e to the minus 2 tau, such that the shift in tau exactly compensates the scaling in the metric. And I can also build an A hat, which is just A minus d beta, which is also a gauge invariant and vial invariant combination. And of course, then I can build vial invariants out of these guys here. So at two derivative level, the vial invariants that I would build would simply be the Ricci scalar constructed out of the hatted metric. This is manifestly vial invariant. And this exactly gives rise to the combination of 1/6 r plus d tau squared e to the minus 2 tau that you saw before and gave us the kinetic term. And the only other thing I can really do is to, at this order, is to contract 2 a hats with a hatted metric. This is also manifestly vial and gauge invariant. And if I just take the flat space limit of this, then, or the trivial background limit, I'll end up with a kinetic term for the kinetic term for the gauge for the mode beta. And then this is the same one you saw in the slide before. So now we need another slide. Dennis, please. Okay, so for four derivative invariants, which are the ones that we really have to worry about, that come in and could possibly affect things, we have to construct them out of the same hadded variables. And we just basically write down a list. We only need to list the ones that are independent under things like Bianchi identities and, under Bianchi identities and partial integration, because they sit in the action. So let's see where they went. Okay, so we write down all such terms. We find nine different ones at four derivative order, and you see some examples of them here. Most are pretty obvious ones. And as I mentioned, if you use the Bianchi identities, an invariant such as this one here is related back to a total derivative plus one of the other ones, so this one doesn't count separately. So basically, the conclusion is now the whole piece of violent gauge invariant terms that you have to take into account are the two derivative ones that I just talked about, plus any linear combination of these W's. And by writing this down, what we have taken into account is all the information that we could get out of the symmetry properties here. So the rest must be up to supersymmetry. Now, if we go ahead and just leave the slides, leave the projector up. If we go ahead and compare with Swimmer and Tyson, we can try to find some coefficients of these gammas, which are constants, such that we match their action. And it turns out that there is such a combination. And so match the Swimmer and Tyson. And you do this by a particular linear combination of those coefficients. It's not so important what it is, but I'll tell you. So you know that I know. The basic point is that they're all fixed in terms of the flow of A. And that's also what you expect by looking at Swimmer-Tyson, where everything here, although it's messy, has the coefficient of delta A. Okay. So it looks fine. We can do this. But there are some things that you cannot be completely sure of in this kind of business, which are factors of two and minus signs and conventions. So can we really be sure that when we fix the coefficients of gammas to be this and all the other gammas to be zero, that we really have a supersymmetric form of the action? Of course, we only have the bosonic parts. So you could go ahead and do the Suzy transformations of this, but this will not be fun because there are four derivative terms involved. So that's not a good approach. But there is another nice approach that you can use, which I learned from studying scattering amplitudes, and that is the supersymmetric watered entities. So in order to use this, you want to take the flat space limit, the trivial background, and try to understand what kind of constraints supersymmetry imposes on the relation between the amplitudes that involve the dilaton and its partner from the other, from the broken gauge symmetries. And if the action that you get doesn't satisfy that, you know it's not supersymmetric. So let me explain very briefly how the supersymmetric watered entities work. So the idea is that you have a chiral scalar. Let me write that here. So I take a chiral massless scalar. Let's call it zeta in an n equals 1 Suzy model. And if I do a super transformation on it, I get a super parameter times some fermion that I'll call lambda. And then if I take this combination, I know how the fields transform together with the free field expansion. What I can infer is how the creation annihilation operators transform under supersymmetry. So how A and A dagger with the different states transform under Suzy. And so the result is what I show you up here. So think of, for example, Q Q dagger as something that, say, raises helicity by one. So if lambda encodes the creation of the negative helicity mode, then when I act on it with something that raises the helicity, I get a scalar. But if I try to raise it again, I get zero because it's just n equals one. And similarly, for the conjugate states, I get the opposite action. And Q, of course, does exactly the opposite thing. Now, the cats that are written here is really just a way of encoding the momentum variables. So think of them as the fermion wave functions, if you wish. They really can also just be related to when I take a dot product of a massless, these are massless particles, so I take a massless momentum and dot into a Pauli matrix. I can, since this will have determinant zero, I can write as a combination of two component vectors. And what it shows up is each of those. Okay. And out of those two component vectors, I can form these Lorentz invariant antisymmetric products, so raise and lower indices with the Levi-Civita 2 index tensor. Okay, so what can I do with this? Well, suppose I take a supersymmetry generator and I act on a string of these creation annihilation operators and I sandwich it between the in and out vacuum. I trivially have to get zero because supersymmetry annihilates the vacuum. So I have zero here, but I can also start acting with supersymmetry on each of the states. But Q dagger kills zeta. So the only thing I get something non-trivial from is acting on the first state, who has momentum P1. And so I can infer from this, since this is the generic momentum, I can infer that this object here has to be zero. But that's exactly the same statement as saying that the 2-to-2 scattering amplitude for four zetas have to be zero. Okay. Another example where I get something a little less trivial, I have two states that now contribute in the process. And this gives me a result that the four scattering amplitude with one zeta bar and three zetas have to be zero. You could try to continue and see what you get out of things with two zeta bars and two zetas, but you just don't find a constraint that allows you to conclude it's vanishing. It can be non-vanishing. And these identities that you get here, these in general linear relations for the amplitudes, are known as the supersymmetric Ward identities. So what does this teach us? Well, we can get, by the argument I gave you, you can get a whole series of results for amplitudes that have to be vanishing. So if all the particles are the same for the scalar, they're zero. If one or three of them are the same, then it's zero. And as I said, this guy here and various other combinations can be non-vanishing. So now let's write zeta in its real and imaginary parts and infer from these field definitions what kind of constraints the top relations here give you on the real and imaginary parts for the scattering amplitudes. Well, so the real imaginary particles that comes out of these fields, so the real fields. And what you find is that the 4 phi amplitude has to be exactly the same as the 4 xi amplitude. And there's also a rule that says that the linear combinations of the ones with 2 dilatons, if you wish, and 2 axions have to add up in this way and give the 4 dilaton amplitude. So that means that if you have an action that only involves the dilaton but not the axion, it cannot be supersymmetric because it would make this amplitude here non-vanishing from the, in our case, the d phi to the 4 term, whereas this one here would be 0, and that's incompatible with supersymmetry. So this is why the action that I wrote over here, which was just the Wessomino term, I claimed it was not supersymmetric by itself because it only had dilaton interactions in the flat space limit. That's exactly because of this. It just cannot, it's not compatible with supersymmetry. Okay. So I told you that we matched our combination of the Wessomino term plus a certain linear combination of the Weyl invariants to get the result by Swimmer and Tyson. Now let's take the trivial background limit of that, write out what we get, and ask if that's compatible with super Ward identities. You can rewrite this by combining this into a complex scalar Z. It takes a slightly nicer form. But what we're really interested is in the form where we have the physical modes. So we expand our Z in terms of some zeta, conveniently related to the dilaton in action, as in the previous slide. And what you get is this action here. So canonical kinetic terms and interaction terms that exactly encode amplitudes that obey the supersymmetric Ward identities. So I gave here the first identity we had to check, that 4 dilatons and 4 axions have the same amplitude. And then you see here the case of two of each kind. There's a minus sign now. So if I exchange phi and psi, it's the same as exchanging momenta 2 and 3, so I exchange S and T. So the minus sign moves over to T, and if I add up such three contributions, it ends up exactly being what you see here. So all three watered entities, all two watered entities are satisfied for the action. Okay, now, so I showed you, I gave you two arguments for why we found the right bosonic form of the n equals 1 supersymmetric form of the action for the dilaton and axion. But is it unique? Could we have added other independently supersymmetric term to the action? So we can take all our Weyl and Gage invariants and ask if there's some linear combination of those that would be independently supersymmetric. Now, you see that in order to do this, you have to kill all the terms with the psi to the fourth, because there's no d tau to the fourth here to give the four-particle matching that you need. So what you're left with then, after killing all the four chi's, would be combinations that would give amplitudes of this form here. But you know that the sum of those three have to add up to a four-particle amplitude with four phi's, and since there's no such thing, there's no linear combinations of those that can be compatible with supersymmetry. So basically what we've shown is that there's no other contributions that can possibly contribute to four-particle scattering at low energies. And so this allows us to conclude for sure that there's no effect on the four-dilaton scattering amplitude or the Komogodzki-Swimmer argument, as anticipated. Okay, so the final remarks here is that we clarified. Maybe we should take the slides up again, please. And I'll just pull down one slide and conclude, one blackboard and conclude. Okay. Good. So again, the upshot is the action does not affect the A theorem, and we clarified the form of the n equals 1 action. So let's talk about outlook. Okay, so I started out by talking about A theorems in the first place. And so we went from 2D to 4D. So the natural question is to ask what happens in six dimensions. And we started characterizing the approach using this type of ideas together with Rob and collaborators in 2012. But we found that we could not use the same dispersion relation argument to carry through a proof. There are certain obstructions to this. And since then, I've been occasionally contacted by various people who say that we got it, and then no, we don't have it. So nobody has proven this yet, so it's up for grabs. And I think it would be fun to know whether the A theorem is true in six dimensions or whether there are really other things happening. So there are no counterexamples. You can look at the dilaton effective action in any dimension. The A theorem is really only applicable in even dimensions, since that's where you have the trace anomaly. There's no trace anomaly in odd dimensions. You can characterize, nonetheless, the dilaton effective action in any dimension and ask whether it has to do with anything. And it actually has a rather interesting structure that involves some mathematical generalizations of the conformal Laplacian that we wrote down. We also first saw that in that earlier paper, GJMS operators. And so this was something we looked at in a paper with Tim Olson. And so you might ask if this thing has anything to do with odd dimensions. Now, in odd dimensions, again, you don't have a trace anomaly, but there's another interesting quantity, particularly in three dimensions, that gives you an F theorem. And the F is related to free energy. And also, as Rob has shown, C and A and F are all related to entanglement entropy. And there is an entanglement entropy proof of this F theorem, but it would be interesting to know if there is a field theory proof of this. And finally, I will reveal to you why we even looked at these n equals 1 actions in the first place. So together with Tim and Nikolai, we studied some flows across dimensions. So what exactly does this mean? Well, obviously, if I change the dimension as I go from the UV to the IR, I've broken Lorentz invariance, so I don't expect a priori to any of these A theorems to apply. They all assume Lorentz invariance. But then nonetheless, you can get something interesting out of this. There's interesting models. So if I take M5 brains wrapped on a 2D Riemann surface, then at very high energies, you don't see that you have some compact surface. But as you go down in dimensions, you effectively go from a 6D theory to a 4D theory. And you can do similar with the free brains going from 4D to 2D. Now, the form of the dilaton effective action depends on which dimension that you're in. And so we were curious to see, in this case here, if we could see the continuous interpolation between the 6D form in which the A anomaly is captured by 6 derivative terms to 4D, where it's captured by 4 derivative terms. And you can see this in very special examples where there are explicit holographic duals of these flows. Now, in order to understand the effective actions we got in those cases, we actually had to deal with a situation where we had n equals 1 supersymmetry. And in order to have supersymmetry, what you needed was a twist, so there's a background gauge field turned on. And so that led us to try to understand what n equals 1 supersymmetric actions for dilaton action type of systems look like. We got confused, and that's the resolution of that confusion is what I've tried to tell you here. So that's the story. So thank you. Perhaps, but I don't think I know any explicit ones. Does anybody else know? Any?
Magarsky-Schwimmer proof. So if you have, I guess with supersymmetry, it's okay. But if you have other Goldstone bosons that are massless that aren't supersymmetric, it's still possible.
Good, good. So very good. So how much do we need supersymmetry to exclude the interference of other Goldstone bosons?
We actually don't need it at the end of the day. So in the particular story, I fixed the gamma coefficients in such a way that we got supersymmetry. But suppose I just leave them invariant. Then I still know that the only thing I can possibly add to the action at four derivative order will be some linear combination of those guys. But I don't know if you remember the slide, but in those form, when you take the flat space limit, none of them contain, well, the only thing that they contain are terms like the xi to the fourth and the xi squared d phi squared. So at the level of just wanting to understand phi to phi to phi scattering, these can never interfere. And so although they can affect what the axion is doing, they're not going to affect the scattering at all. So yes, you're absolutely right that even for the case without supersymmetry, we can conclude that Goldstone modes for U1s don't interfere with anything. Very good. Oh yes, also for multiple Goldstones, you basically can't do anything else. Yeah.
More questions? Well, if not, let's thank Henriette again.